And you can take that in whatever way you want to, brethren. And it certainly is true. You know, we never know in our own personal lives when that might be appropriate in a special sense. We appreciate the prayer very much. We want to first of all bring you love and greetings from your brethren in Romania in general and in Szeged in particular, where I take part, and also the Wenatchee, Washington Ecclesia, where I have the privilege of attending from time to time. And from the two online meetings I attend regularly, Sunday Evening Study, which is European-based in many countries, especially Brother Kent in Sweden, but other places too, won't go through the list, and the International Internet Meeting on Monday night. They all want their love sent. And every place that we've been so far, we started in Chicago, over to Connellsville, down to Starkville, Mississippi, to Orlando Convention, Cape Coral, Florida, Naples, Florida, Atlanta, Georgia, Boaz, Alabama, Columbus, Indiana, Gulfport, Mississippi, Austin, Texas, Denver, Colorado, San Diego, Los Angeles. Did I miss any? Phoenix. Really glad to be here in Phoenix. And we thank the brethren who entertained us in their homes, and for each of you for your warm love and fellowship. When I was a youngster, maybe about 9 or 10, my mother had a collection of cards, old postcards. And one of them, it had a picture of an older woman. She was dressed like she was going somewhere and had her bags and everything. And the caption below it was, "Well, I don't know where I'm going, but I'm on my way." And that certainly is something that a lot of us can relate to in life, in general, and in specific circumstances. And it's related to our subject. We'll make that connection here soon. But who is in charge of where we're going? You know, that's a question. And that's maybe the key question to this discourse. Who's in charge? And we hopefully allow the Lord to be the one who's directing where we're going, even if at times we're not sure. The subject is neither murmur nor repine, and it identifies a problem. But what we hope to be able to look at together today is not only the problem, but also the solution. And if we were going to try to put that solution in one word, I don't know which one you'd pick. Maybe a different one. It might be even more appropriate. But I would choose the word rejoice. Rejoice. And when looking at the definition of that word, I was especially impressed with the propriety of using that word. Because in the Greek, the word means to delight in God's grace. To delight in God's grace. So if you're taking notes, and if the only note you take is murmur and repine, that's the negative. The positive is rejoice, and it means to delight in God's grace. And that's not always easy. I have done more than my share of murmuring and repining. And I'm ashamed of that, because after all these years, you'd think that I would have learned that the Lord always comes through. He has 100% track record. Now, we also see that this is the Phoenix New Year's Convention. And when we think of New Year's, we think of resolutions, and the brethren have talked about that. And there's a number of thoughts contained in this subject that the brethren have already brought out. We're thankful for that. And I'm sure you're aware that a lot of people in the world, and ourselves too, have trouble keeping resolutions. And there's some common problems with that. But in order to be able to keep a resolution, we need to make sure it's something that we can try to put into practice every day. It's got to be realistic. It's got to be achievable. It's got to be practical. And for us especially, it needs to be scriptural. So we want to talk about resolutions And we want to tie that in with neither murmur nor repine. And I'm sure when we mention the two most frequent places where we would find that, you'll understand. Psalm 116, 12 to 14. You heard it this morning. What shall I render unto the Lord for all His benefits towards me? I'll take the cup of salvation. I'll call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all His people. You have there the idea of making a resolution, but not only making that resolution, but there's another aspect which, what's the term I would use, that we could use? We have to be accountable. And we can make ourselves accountable, not just to the Lord, but to each other. And I found this very useful in my own endeavors along these lines. And it says, pay our vows unto the Lord in the presence of His people. Now, I'm not suggesting that you get up and you tell all the brethren what your New Year's resolutions are, but it would be good if you have at least one trusted individual that you might say, you know, this year I'm going to try to do this and hold me accountable. And maybe you can do the same for them. It's a good idea. Well, you know where this scripture is used. It's used in the morning resolve. We'll touch on that. It's also used in a manna that was brought out earlier at the convention, and that's the manna for December 31st. And the whole subject of that has to do with making new resolutions for the year to come. And I really like that phrase, and I think it was Brother John that mentioned this. Good resolves, respecting what we shall be willing to be, to do, to suffer, and fellowship with our Lord, that we may, by His grace, make of it the best year thus far of our lives. The year of largest hopes, largest endeavors, and by the Lord's grace, largest successes. That's what we hope for. And it mentions a number of things. We won't go through the list for sake of time. But if you look at that manna text, you can make your own list. They're general ones. And it requires some thought on our part to be able to put those into practical application in our daily lives. We want to look at the morning resolve, and we won't read it because it was already read, but there's also a list of things. I like lists. It's something that my mind can comprehend. Not everybody's the same way. But here you have, strive to be simple and sincere toward all. Now, that's a wonderful daily resolve that we can try to practice. Seek not to please and honor self, but the Lord. And that has to do very much with our consecration. Be careful to honor the Lord with my lips, that my words may be unctuous and blessed to all. Y'all remember the three gates of gold illustration? Don't let anything come out of your mouth unless it passes the three gates of gold. First, is it true? Second, is it necessary? Third, is it loving or kind? Very important. I will seek to be faithful to the Lord, the truth to brethren, and all with whom I have to do, not only in the great matters, but also in the little things of life. Now, that's daily application. Little things of life. Repelling anxiety, discontent, and discouragement. I remember that because it's ADD. And we don't want spiritual ADD. But we're most particularly interested for our study today. We could take any one of these and expand on it to a large extent. But we want to look at this last phrase. I will neither murmur nor repine at what the Lord's providence may permit, because faith can firmly trust Him, come what may. You see the connections that are made here. Murmuring and repining is a result of failing to have faith and trust in God's leading in our lives. To put it in a positive way, we could say it like this. I will, what's the word for the opposite for murmur and repine? I will rejoice. I will rejoice at all the Lord's providence may permit, because faith can firmly trust Him, come what may. We can take any situation in our lives that might, our flesh might say, I'm going to murmur and repine. And rather than doing that, we say, I'm going to rejoice. Not always easy. Takes practice. But we can do it, and there's good reasons for doing that. Okay. We ought to define murmuring and repining. Let's kind of stay away from that because we want to focus on the positive. You know, it's one thing to identify a problem, but we shouldn't identify a problem unless we have a solution for it. And we have that. Definition for murmur and repine. Well, they both share to express discontent. Murmuring is arguing, complaining, grumbling, moaning, muttering. Repining, you can add belly aching, griping, nagging, whining. Oh, those are awful things. But how often do we do them? Maybe without even thinking. I do. Now, but the question here is, would we ever intentionally do any of those against God? Not if we think about it. No. But really, if we engage in murmuring and repining and what happens to us in our consecrated lives, then we're expressing discontent with God. That's pretty powerful. So let's rejoice. Philippians 4:4, rejoice in the Lord. And again I say rejoice. Paul found it necessary to repeat himself. To delight in God's grace. I like that definition. Now, why do we feel that this is an important lesson for us? Because the Apostle Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he brings it to our attention. He's talking there about Israel and the things that they did, and that all these things were pictures and illustrations for us, types and shadows. And that's in verse 6 in 1 Corinthians 10. But we're especially interested in verse 10. Because here, he's talking about what the Israelites did when they murmured and repined. And he says, don't do that. So there's special lessons for us. And so what we're going to focus our time on, the time that we have remaining, is some illustrations from the nation of Israel. They were God's people, God's covenant people, and lessons we can learn regarding murmuring and repining. And, of course, the antonym of that, rejoicing. We're going to start in Exodus 3. We're not going to read a lot of verses. These are Bible stories, and I think a lot of you know these Bible stories by heart. But it has to do with the nation of Israel being in slavery in Egypt. And, of course, they cried to God for deliverance, and he heard them. Exodus 3, verses 7 and 9. Exodus 3, 7 and 9. And you remember what he did. Moses had been prepared through his life experiences, and he had many occasions he might have murmured or repined during those 80 years. But now he was ready, and Lord sent him to be their deliverer. And God gave him three signs that he would show them to prove that he was sent by God. And so he went and he gathered them together, the leaders and the people, and he showed them the signs and he says, oh, okay, we recognize you are a servant of God. We accept what you're going to do. Easy to say, not so easy to put into practice. So you remember what happens next. Moses goes to Pharaoh and he asks Pharaoh to let the people go. And what does Pharaoh say? You got too much free time on your hands. I'll fix that. So he makes them gather the straw in order to make the bricks instead of it being supplied to them. Well, was this the Lord's providential overruling? It sure was. Was it easy to see? No, it wasn't. And how did the people react? How did the Jews react? They murmured. Then they even questioned if this was God's will. And we have that in Exodus 5:21 and Exodus 6:9. 5:21 and 6:9. Now, what are the lessons for us? Well, one of them is that accepting God's will has consequences. Now, if we recognize that it's His will and we recognize that He knows what He's doing, then those consequences, we should be able to accept them. We should be able to rejoice in them, even if it's not easy for us. When we made a consecration, what was the basis of it? And I appreciated the baptismal discourse yesterday because it brings these things to our minds again. We give up our will to do God's will. But there's another little dimension to add to this. It's not only doing God's will, but we have to do it in God's way. God's will in God's way. Now, why is it necessary to say that? Because what happens? What happened with the Jews happens to me. I'm sure it happens to you too. God shows us His will. You know, we signed the blank sheet of paper. I'll do whatever you ask, Lord. And then He asks us to do something and we say, well, wait a minute. I didn't think you were going to ask me to do that. Or I didn't think you were going to ask me to do it in that way. How many times do we want to do God's will, but we want to do it in our way? That's murmuring and repining. And if we try to do things our way, what's going to happen? We're going to mess it up bad. And there's many, many experiences in the Bible that show that, and I'm sure in our own lives, certainly in my life. If we accept God's will in His way, we will always be able to rejoice, come what may. Now, it's interesting that God didn't punish them for murmuring on this occasion. And we think there's reasons for that. They weren't yet in covenant relationship with Him. They didn't have a lot of experience with Him. They were like little children. And so he didn't punish them. He wanted them to develop trust in Him. And He delivered them. Now, we don't know how long that the plagues on Egypt lasted, but every time those plagues occurred, and then it was obvious that this was God doing this, and they could see it with their own eyes, hopefully this developed faith and trust in God. Well, eventually they're delivered, and they leave Egypt, and they march to the Red Sea. And I don't know how many days that took, but they get to the Dead Sea, or the Red Sea, not the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, excuse me. And what happens? Well, Pharaoh has a change of heart, and he pursues after them his whole army, and they go after them. And here you have the Jews, they're bound in by the water on this side, and they see Pharaoh's army coming on the other side. Well, you know, I'd probably be a little bit scared too, wouldn't you? And so what did they do? Well, they did what they were very good at. They murmured. Now, they murmured against Moses, but because Moses was God's representative, He proved that to them. They're murmuring against God. And what did they say? They said, we would have preferred Egyptian slavery to this. Now, on the surface, it sounds logical, but they're saying we'd prefer Egyptian slavery to trusting in God. So, did God punish them? No. He's still cutting them some slack, as we would say. He's still trying to show them that they can trust Him, that they can have faith in Him. And He delivered them miraculously. You know, I have to ask myself, you know, I wonder what would my reaction be to all this that happened during that time with all the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea. And it's just incredible miracles. But as you well know, it didn't last. And it makes me wonder about the efficacy of miraculous means. I think they're nice as a confirmation of God's working with us. But He doesn't particularly deal with the new creation in this way, although I think there's a lot of things that happen to us that are miracles, but maybe not so obvious, like the parting of the Red Sea. But there's other things that are more important and more lasting, and it's the developing of that faith and trust in God. And it takes time, and it takes experience. And hopefully in our lives, we come to that point. God is patient with us in the building of our faith and trust in Him. Faith can firmly trust Him, come what may. That last part's the hard part. Well, Exodus 16. Oh, I should have given you the reference on that Red Sea. That's Exodus 14. Exodus 14 was the Red Sea. 9 to 14 in particular, but also especially verses 11 and 12 is where they murmured. Now we go to Exodus 16. And this is only 30 days after they left Egypt. only a few weeks after they crossed the Red Sea. And all those miracles that we talked about to this point, still fresh in their minds. And what did they do? They murmured. You know, I have to say an aside here that this study was not on the road that I originally intended to take in making this study. It was going to be a prophetic study about another thing altogether. And in discussing it with brethren, it was a different road. And I'm thankful. I can rejoice in going down that road because this is what came out of it. And it's been a real blessing to me. This thought of the murmuring. And of course, more importantly, how we can combat that. So Exodus 16 is 30 days after they leave Egypt. And in particular, verses 7 and 10. Exodus 16, 7 and 10, the people murmured because they were hungry. They didn't have food. Well, it's interesting how God handles this situation. First of all, through Moses, he says, here's what I'm going to do. That's the first thing he does. And then the second thing he does is he allows some miraculous glory to appear. Might have been Mount Sinai erupting, I don't know, but it was some bright light that occurred as a confirmation that this was from God, and then he did it. He tells them what he's going to do, he gives them a sign, and then he does it. And all this, again, was very carefully thought out, I think, on the part of the Lord to try to cultivate their faith and their trust in him. So, he tells them, he gives them the sign, and then that evening the quail appear. And then the next day, the manna started, and they had that for the rest of their 40 years in the wilderness until they crossed Jordan and were in the promised land. And on that morning, the next morning, it stopped. Well, what are the lessons here? First of all, it's interesting that once again, God did not punish them. It's still early in their experiences, and he gave them what they asked for. He gave them what they asked for. They still lacked experience. He was still showering his abundant grace upon them, nurturing dependence on him, and perhaps another aspect. I believe God wanted them to feel their need, and he wanted them to ask for food. Now, the method that they chose wasn't the right method. They shouldn't have murmured. What kind of different result would it have been if they had rejoicingly said, to Moses, we trust in God. We've seen all that he's done for us so far. And we know that if we ask him for food, he's going to give us food. That would have been a rejoicing experience. Now, they still could rejoice in what God did for them. But they got it through a means that was not the best way. God also wants us to feel our needs and our dependence upon him. He wants us to ask him for the things that we need. He knows what we need, but he wants us to recognize that need, to recognize our dependence upon him for supplying that need, and then to have the proper rejoicing attitude in coming to him and saying, dear Father, I know you will provide everything that I need. And to ask him for the things that we believe are his will. And in the way that he will provide it. God's will in God's way. If we ask God properly, this increases our faith and trust. If we ask God properly, we will receive what we ask for. You know, that's a promise. And Jesus said that. Now, some have taken that the wrong way and say, well, I can ask God for anything, you know, asking for a Cadillac or a new house or whatever. Well, that's not what it means, is it? The whole idea there is if we ask according to God's will, we're guaranteed that we'll get it. Now, it's not always easy to know what God's will is, but we need to study God's will in our lives because that's the basis of our consecration. We consecrated to do his will, and we have to study in order to find out what his will is so that we can do it. And if so, what will we be able to do always, come what may? Rejoice. Numbers. We're going to go to Numbers now, chapter 14. Well, actually, it starts back in chapter 13. Now, this is the story of the 12 spies who were sent into the promised land and to check things out. And they were 40 days spying out the land, and they came back, and they gave a report. And you remember this incident. 10 of the spies, they said, we can't do it. And Joshua and Caleb said, yes, we can. And what did the people do? They murmured. And so much so, they wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb. Numbers 14:10 in particular is the kind of the key text here. Well, God responds to their murmuring. Now, their murmuring in this case was related to fear. It demonstrated a lack of trust, a lack of faith in God. And those were all the essential elements that we've been looking at so far in examining this subject. Their previous murmuring had to do with temporal needs, food. And in that case, he gave them what they asked for. Remember? They said, we're hungry. He says, okay, I'll give you food. And he gave them the quail. He gave them the manna. Now, on two previous occasions, they asked for something, and he didn't give it to them. And that was in Exodus 14:12 and Exodus 16:3. Exodus 14:12 and Exodus 16:3. They asked for the wrong thing, and he didn't give it to them because what they asked for wasn't in their best interest. And he was still being generous and loving and gracious and kind to them and trying to develop that proper faith and trust. But guess what? This time, they asked for something that wasn't in their best interests, and God gave it to them. You know, that expression, he gave it to them, has more than one meaning. He really gave it to them. What did they say? Be better if we die here in the wilderness. Not enter the promised land. We don't want to enter the promised land. So what did he do? He says, okay, I've tried, and I'm going to give you what you asked for. You're not going to enter the promised land. And you're going to die in this wilderness. He gave them what they asked for. But what they asked for was the wrong thing. We have to be so careful. Be careful what you ask for because you might get it. Let's make sure it's God's will that we're asking for. And that we don't persist in asking for the wrong thing. And as you know, of that generation, it was only Joshua and Caleb who were the exceptions, and they got to enter the promised land. But they had to wait. They had to wait 40 years. There's a lesson here that our murmuring can have a negative effect on others. We need to be careful. Now, it wasn't a problem for Joshua and Caleb. Because why? Because they had faith. They had trust. They could rejoice in any experience, come what may. They had what was necessary. So the 40 years, they endured that joyfully. The sins of the people in this case was murmuring against Moses and Aaron. And as we mentioned earlier, because they were God's representatives, they were really murmuring against God. And in fact, their desire to stone Joshua and Caleb and the other things they did was really a mutiny against God's arrangements. These are pretty strong sins. They were willing to exchange their inheritance for Egyptian slavery. Now, what does that remind you of? Reminds me, yes, of Esau. It reminds us of Esau. He sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. We don't want to do that. We want to trust God, we want to have faith in Him, and recognize that anything that He permits to happen is for a good reason. Not just a reason, but a good reason. Now, God punished them this time because they had some experience. They saw what God had done for them. They should have learned from that experience. And, interestingly enough, the punishment that God gave them really suited the crime. It was the most appropriate to their sin. Because He gave them what they asked for. What better punishment than to give them what they asked for? Well, brethren, the lesson for us is let's try to be like Joshua and Caleb. Let's try to rejoice at the Lord's providence, come what may, whatever that is. Okay, moving on in Numbers, chapter 16. Now you'd think, no, I'm not going to say it, because who am I to say? Because, you know, I look at myself and I say, yeah, you would think, after all that, you would learn your lesson. Number 16. Not that long after this, we have not one murmuring, but two. One right after the other. Back to back. Double header. Whatever you want to call it. This was concerning the rebellion of Korah. And you remember Korah was a Levite. And the Levites, they had a special place in the plan of God, in the nation of Israel. They were a separated people. They had the privilege of working with the tabernacle and all the religious things. But they weren't priests. Korah wasn't satisfied. We're just as good as you. We can be priests too. And not only did he come himself and tell Moses and Aaron this, but he brings 250 of the most influential people he could gather up. String polling, wire polling, party spirit. Those are all things that should be far from us. But, you know, Paul mentions those things existed even in the early church. The 250 who were with him, they were told, he and they were told, okay, tomorrow, come here to the tabernacle, bring your censers, and we'll see what God says. So here's what God says. They're gathered there through Moses. He says, okay, now, if you were just to drop over dead, you probably would think that was an accident. Although they shouldn't, after all they'd been through. So he says, okay, we're going to do something unique and different here. The earth is going to open up, it's going to swallow you, and it's going to close up again. And we're doing it this way so that you know this is from God. So you know this is from God. So what happens? Sure enough, tells the other people, get away from Korah and his family and their tents and their children and all that. The earth opens up, swallows them up, closes up again. And the 250 who were burning incense, fire comes down from God out of heaven and consumes them. And they took the censers that those 250 were using, they gathered them together, and they made a covering for the altar. It was to be kind of like a memorial, so that they'd never forget this incident. That they weren't allowed to offer strange incense, and that it was only Aaron and his sons who were to be the priests. So that was the end of the story, and everything was great after that, right? No. The next day, what do the people do? They murmured. They come and they say, you killed the people of the Lord. That's what they say to Moses and Aaron. You killed the people of the Lord. Sounds righteous on the surface. But they're murmuring against God's arrangement. We marvel that they could have construed that incident the previous day in that way. Because Moses told them, here's what's going to happen, and we're specifically doing this so that you'll know this is from God, and it happened. So, they get punished. Their punishment is even more severe this time. And there was another 14,700 who died in the plague. But Moses had mercy on them, God's representative, and you remember he took incense and went through the congregation and was able to stop the plague. They were murmuring against God's arrangement. We don't want to do that. And they were guilty of pride and ambition. We don't want to do that. We should rejoice in the Lord's arrangement. No matter how big or how small a place that God gives us, we should rejoice that we have something to do in His service, whatever it is. And not think, well, you know, that brother or that sister, they've got more witness opportunities than I do. We should never feel that way. We should rejoice in whatever the Lord gives us to do. And never to think that our way is better than the Lord's way. Well, let's go ahead a few years. Numbers chapter 20. And we believe we're pretty far into the 40 years here, maybe just a few years before they enter the promised land. This is the next generation of Israelites. And, you know, we have to be so careful, the example that we give to our children. So, what happened? What happened with the next generation of Israelites? What did they learn from their parents? They learned how to murmur. They murmured because they didn't have water. And this incident is particularly sad because all these years, Moses was such a faithful servant. And he tried his best. And he's mentioned amongst the ancient worthies. So what happened here is just an example for us. He's still spoken of highly and one of the top two, you might say, when he's referred to him along with Job, I think. There's no more righteous ones. So we're not saying anything against him, but we are mentioning this incident because some of that murmuring seems to have rubbed off on Moses. Very sad. He said, "Must we fetch water from this rock, ye rebels?" You know that incident. Well, he should have known better. And God punished him severely by not permitting him to enter the promised land. Well, I see this is not the latest version of my notes, but I'll try not to murmur or repine, and I'll try to remember from memory what's missing here. There's an incident in Numbers 21, and maybe you all can help me. In Numbers 21, they murmur again, but this time it's different. And if you can find, somebody can find the verse. There's a verse where this time they seem to get it, and they repent. And they say, after they get punished by the fiery serpents, remember that incident? Verse 7, thank you. And they say, "We made a mistake. We repent. We're sorry. Help us." And he did. That's the happy ending to this murmuring story. The next generation, by the time they get to the end of the 40 years, they've learned their lesson. And hopefully, that's going to be true for us, dear brethren. When we get to the end of our journey through the wilderness, that we will have learned, that we will indeed trust God for anything that happens to us, believing that it comes from Him, come what may. Well, there's one more incident. It's a negative incident. It would be nice to just end with Numbers 21:7 and say that's the end of the story. But, you know, this murmuring theme, it kind of repeats time and again. And we come to the period that's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And there, the Israelites come to Samuel, and they're murmuring again. You remember what they're murmuring about this time? "We want a king." They're not satisfied with God's arrangement. And why do they want a king? Because we want to be like everybody else. Now, I mean, how many times have you heard that expression from your kids or when you were a kid? "But Johnny's got, you know, he's able to do that, or he can stay up late," or whatever it is. Well, God says, "I don't want you to be like everybody else. You're special people." And that's a picture for us in the Christian dispensation. He doesn't want us to just be like anybody else. He wants us to be able to relate to everybody else in the world, because that's who we're going to be dealing with. And these failures that we have, one after the another, they're going to be useful. And we'll be able to rejoice even in our failures. We can now. And certainly then, if we can help the world of mankind. But He doesn't want us to just be like anybody else. He wants us to be His peculiar people. Special people. Separated people. So He says to Samuel, remember in verse 7, in 1 Samuel 8, verse 7, "They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me." Even after God warned them through Samuel of all the consequences. He says, if you ask for a king, it's going to be this, 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 and this. He's going to take everything from you. They still wanted a king. So once again, what does He do? After all the warnings, He gives them what they ask for. And they suffered the consequences. This time, for centuries. Let us strive to accept God's will and God's way in our lives, neither murmur nor repine, but to try to see that this is for our best interest, that whatever He asks us is for good. And if we can see that, we can accept it and rejoice in it. Well, believe it or not, we're going to end early, brethren. In conclusion, the primary lessons are that God's ways are always better than our own. And He wants that lesson to be deeply engraved on our hearts and minds. The results of God's way and God's will are always a blessing. Always. No exceptions. Even when they seem to the contrary. Even on the surface when we don't understand. Well, I'll give you a few examples since we've got the time. I would never have asked to have the hood of the car smash into the windshield at 70 miles an hour. I would never ask for that. But you know, Sister Sherelle and I have been rejoicing in that. We have. Because it wasn't pleasant at the time, but we saw positive results from it. And you know, it's wonderful when the Lord delivers us and we can see, wow, He delivered us. It was His hand. It wasn't anything we did. Now, I haven't always been victorious in rejoicing. And another one, very personal to me, I would not have asked for my natural brother to get terminal cancer. But that's the reason I'm here in the United States, is because I came to spend some time with him. I'm glad that he's good with it, even though he doesn't believe as we do. He has some faith. But you know, I can rejoice in that because the Lord has brought so many blessings out of it. And among them is my brother, who's not in the truth, has been an example to me of neither murmuring nor repining in that experience. And man, if he can do it, I ought to be able to do it too. And to rejoice in all of the places that the Lord permitted me to be, including here with you. The results are always a blessing, even when on the surface they might seem to be difficult. So brethren, when we leave from this convention and we go home, let's go there with that greater determination than ever that was mentioned in that December 31st manna text. To neither murmur nor repine, but to always rejoice in the Lord's providences, because faith can firmly trust Him, come what may. May the Lord add His blessing.